negative impact on communities of color, unquote. Walensky noted the impact of COVID-19 pandemic has been felt most severely in communities of color, which have experienced disproportionate case counts and deaths. And in weather today in Washington, D.C., it is 55 degrees and cloudy. In New York City, 56 degrees and partly cloudy. From WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin.
The previous program was the Gary Knoll Show, heard Monday through Friday at noon. It is now 1 p.m. Stay tuned for Leonard Lopez at Large here at WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned.
Really matter.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. The United States is the only country in the world where property rights give landowners the exclusive right to lease their subsurface mineral estates to petroleum companies. And that's led to the increasing use of the hydraulic form of extraction of shale oil and gas, commonly known as fracking, despite the health problems and environmental damage it causes. Up to Heaven and Down to Hell, the latest book by Colin Jeromak, an environmental studies professor at NYU, explores what happens when Americans of all political stripes are forced by circumstances to reconsider their beliefs about their land, their neighbors, and their government. It's published by Princeton University Press and brings Professor Jeromak to our show now. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for being here. Long-time listener. It's an honor to be here.
Well, it's great to have you because this is a fascinating topic. What makes shale oil and gas such a valued commodity? Is it different than other oil and gas reserves?
No, it's not, Leonard. It's the same substance. It's that, if you think about the past several decades, there's been a lot of anxiety around peak oil. And, you know, in the early 2000s, it looked like, in addition to environmental concerns, that we were going to be running out of this stuff soon. And what happened really is just the technological shift. This oil and gas that's called shale gas and shale oil is because it's trapped deep underground in the strata of shale, and traditional drilling methods couldn't get at it. So it was only when we introduced this technique of horizontal drilling. So you drill down to the shale and drill horizontally through it, and then you hydraulically fracture the rock by shooting through this water at high pressure, that we were able to get this oil and gas out. So it's not that it's different in its value. It's just that it's opened up vast new reserves of oil and gas, which have the potential to keep us going on this stuff, no matter the harm it does to the environment, for decades.
And shale is soft, finely stratified sedimentary rock. Wherever you find it, is it usually rich in oil and gas?
Not everywhere, no, but there are parts of even the layers in North America where oil and gas is in some of the strata of shale. It's not in other parts, but in many parts of the United States, Pennsylvania in particular, and New York, although there's a ban on fracking in New York, but the so-called Marcellus Shale region, the whole thing is laced with gas, and it's some of the most valuable, or it's the biggest, one of the biggest gas fields and most valuable gas fields in the world.
And ironically, even though New York has banned the drilling of shale, some of the fracked oil and gas is sent to a New York facility in the Hudson Valley for processing. In Dover Plains.
Absolutely, yes. And actually, in addition to that, there's more. There's other pipelines, like a pipeline that's worming its way through Brooklyn right now, that is delivering fracked gas to many parts of New York City and other parts. So New York State, you know, heats a lot of homes through shale gas, and that gas, a lot of it is coming from Pennsylvania.
Where does the word fracking come from? And when did fracking begin?
You know, fracking, I only laugh because, you know, to many people, fracking sounds like a curse word.
Yeah.
And it's kind of become a pejorative word. Fracking was originally industry slang for hydraulic fracturing, right? So fracturing becomes fracking. And that's the process by which you drill horizontally through the shale layer. And then once you've done that, you drop down these depth charges, basically, which explode ball bearings through the shale rock to put cracks into it. And then you inject at incredibly high pressure millions of gallons of mostly water, but also with sand, which props up the cracks that you've created, and some chemical lubricants. And that's what allows the shale gas and oil to flow back out. So it's an industry term. And we've been, you know, we haven't been fracking that long. I mean, it really took off in the early 2000s. I mean, certainly there had been experiments in hydraulic fracturing for decades before that. And that's a lot of times the industry will say that fracking isn't new. And that's correct in the sense that this technology has existed for decades, but it's not been used on a vast scale until it was combined with horizontal drilling. And so that really took off in the early to mid 2000s.
And it's often portrayed as an energy revolution that will transform the American economy and geopolitics, at least by its defenders. Is that because it frees us from relying on foreign oil and gas?
Yes, in theory. And I say in theory because, you know, oil and gas are a commodity like anything else. And so even though it's being taken out of the ground here, if there's better markets for it elsewhere, it will be, and it is being shipped out. But yes, the idea is that, you know, we were dependent on foreign oil, and some people even arguing that this was part of the impetus to get involved in things like the Iraq War. And so the idea was, you know, now we don't have to import oil and gas, and we can even export it. It also, you know, Europe can look to us for fracked gas rather than having to look to Gazprom in Russia. And so that's been the promise, so much so that even Energy Secretary Perry under the Trump administration called fracked gas molecules of U.S. freedom.
But we've also heard about the damage that methane can cause. And isn't there methane damage in the process, methane leakage in the process?
Yes. So just to be clear for listeners, methane is natural gas. So the methane gas that's being taken out that we call natural gas is the primary component that we are extracting and using for fuel. Methane is itself a greenhouse gas. We usually talk about carbon emissions. Methane itself is another greenhouse gas. And although it stays in the atmosphere for a shorter period of time, when it is in the atmosphere, its potency is much greater than carbon emissions. And so methane is a very potent greenhouse gas. And, you know, it can be leaked out at many stages in the process. A lot of times when a gas well is first drilled, there can be methane released. A lot of old wells that have been abandoned, they call them orphan wells, are leaking methane. And when, you know, a lot of times, so pipelines are hooked up to these things called compressor stations, which pressurize the gas to send it through longer distance pipelines. And compressor stations sometimes will emit methane. And so we really don't know how much methane is being leaked, because especially under Trump, there was a lot of rollback on emissions monitoring of methane.
You looked at the impact of fracking by living for 8 months in a rural communities in Lycoming County, Pennsylvania, outside of Williamsport. And that sits atop the Marcellus Shale.
Right.
Now, Marcellus Shale is very rich in oil and natural gas. 4 trillion cubic feet of natural gas, it's estimated to hold.
Yes, the Marcellus Shale is the largest gas field in America and one of the largest in the world.
Doesn't the title of your book refer to early American laws that extended property rights up to heaven and down to hell?
That's right. So this is actually a clause that has been found in common law handed down from Britain, and not only to the United States, but you'll find a clause something like this: whoever owns the soil, it is theirs up to heaven and down to hell, in many of the other Commonwealth countries that are, you know, that were originally British colonies, like Canada, for instance. But But in all of those other countries, that right has been eroded or has not been recognized in practice. So in England, for instance, people own the mineral rights, but the crown retains access to all of the most prized minerals, gold, silver, gas, and oil. And so in that sense, then you don't really own down to hell. But in America, it's the only country where this is actually common. Other countries have small, you know, there can be longtime landowners that were able to get that grandfathered in where they own mineral rights. But in America, 2/3 of all owned land has the mineral rights attached to it. And almost all that other third is federally owned public land. And so, of course, air rights were restricted after plane travel. But originally, the clause was up to heaven and down to hell. And in America, for most landowners, it's called freehold title. If you have a freehold title, it is all the way down to the mantle of the earth.
So that's led to poor regulation of the fracking industry by the U.S. government, because it's really the property owners who are the only ones involved in it. It doesn't matter what health problems and environmental damage it may cause, the government still can't say anything?
Well, that's not quite it. The government can say something, but you are correct that property rights, I argue, inhibit regulation. So starting at the top, the fracking could be and should be regulated by the federal government. But the reason why the federal government tends not to be involved, part of it is just our federalist system where there's been a decision to devolve much of regulations to the state. The other thing with the famous or infamous Halliburton loophole, Dick Cheney, when he became vice president, he was previously the CEO of Halliburton, which is one of the largest oil field services companies in the world. And he was able to slip into the Energy Act that fracking was exempt from the Safe Drinking Water Act. And that would have been the primary mechanism by which the Environmental Protection Agency regulated things like, for instance, injection wells where fracking wastewater is buried deep underground. That's what is primarily considered to be causing earthquakes, not so much fracking itself, but these injection wells. So now you have it at the level of the state. And there, of course, every state has a regulatory body. In Pennsylvania, it's the Environmental Protection Agency that is supposed to ensure that, you know, the health and safety of this enterprise. And so there are these regulatory bodies. But for instance, in Pennsylvania, even last year, the district attorney convened a grand jury to investigate the Department of Environmental Protection because they were and the grand jury found the DEP to be so lax in its enforcement of the industry that the grand jury recommended giving some authority to criminally prosecute and regulate the industry to the attorney general himself. And so there are those regulatory bodies, but where specifically we see that it comes down to property owners is one of the things that happened in most states that are drilling a lot of oil and gas, like Pennsylvania and Texas and Colorado, is they have suspended towns and municipalities' ability to control fracking locally through zoning. So if you think a lot of towns have zoning, and zoning is the primary mechanism that you would use to control the industry on the local level, a town may say this area is zoned rural or residential, and so we're not going to allow industrial processes in those areas. But Pennsylvania, as did most of the other oil and gas producing states, created a preemption where they said only the state can set, you know, the state controls regulations regarding fracking. And as long as a oil or gas well is not, for instance, within 1,000 feet of the nearest water source, it must be allowed in all zones, including residential and agricultural zones. So now that would have been the mechanism by which at the local level, you can imagine communities saying, I don't want my neighbor to be able to lease their land for drilling. You can't say that. And so the process of signing a lease is just up to the individual. There's no public input into that. There are permitting hearings when a new well is going to be drilled. There is a public permit hearing where people can voice their concerns. But in Pennsylvania, those hearings were basically rubber stamps. And the one time that I followed where a municipality denied a gas permit, they were sued by the industry and it was overturned on appeal. And so the township had to allow the lease in the end.
Environmentalists and some Democratic politicians have been pushing for a national ban on fracking. But isn't President Biden's power limited to only banning fracking on public lands? The vast majority of lease land is privately held, isn't it?
That's right. You're exactly correct, Leonard. And that was something of, you know, in a way, during the presidential election, you know, the right wanted to pin Biden as saying he's going to ban fracking. And then Biden, you know, environmentalists were mad because Biden said, I'm not going to ban fracking. I think it worked to his advantage to not say, I can't ban fracking, because he wanted to find a way to appeal to people in the middle. But you're totally correct. He can only ban on public land. And really, all it seems he's going to do is ban new oil and gas leases. All existing oil and gas permits that have been issued will still be allowed to be developed. And that applies to less than one third of available land that can be used for fracking in the United States.
What was the Trump administration's position on fracking on public lands?
Drill, baby, drill. They seem to be opposed to promoting
renewable energy at the same time.
Yes. No, there was. I mean, I say that only slightly in jest. That was the famous phrase from Sarah Palin and some others from some time ago. But, you know, the Trump administration really made fracking the fulcrum of energy policy and considered, you know, taking any effort they could to open up drilling. I should note that drilling on public land was something that President Obama also took up with relative gusto. So this isn't only a conservative thing. Until, you know, up until about a decade ago or even less, there was pretty strong bipartisan support of fracking. But the Trump administration opened up a lot of new land for oil and gas drilling, including selling leases for the Arctic National Reserve on those final days in office, shrinking the Bears Ears National Monument, which was newly created by Obama, so that more of that space could be opened up for oil and gas drilling.
My guest on today's Let It Lopate at Large here on WBAI New York, streaming live at WBAI.org, is NYU Environmental Studies Professor Colin Jaromak, who's written a book called Up to Heaven and Down to Hell, published by Princeton University Press. Did most of the residents you spoke to say that they felt they should be free to do what they wanted with their own property?
That's right. So you know, Lycoming County is a county that just to give you one marker of the political leanings, that it went over 70% for Donald Trump in both presidential elections. And so it's a quite conservative area. And I would say even for some of the more remotely located rural residents, a libertarian era, many people who, you know, are fourth, fifth generation property owners who very much have this pull yourself up by the bootstraps mentality. Their sort of code of living is live and let live. I do what I want. You do what you want. I don't bother you. You don't bother me. And so they were very much not fans of government regulation in general and environmental regulation in particular. There was this attitude, it's my land, I can do what I want. And so what I argue in the book is that, yes, fracking brought economic benefits, but it wasn't just that people kind of, you know, bit their tongue and signed the lease, that many people, this was in alignment with their political beliefs. You know, they believe that their land should be productive. They believe that it's my land and I can do what I want. And that if I want to make my land productive and make money off it, I should have the freedom to do so. And nobody should be able to tell me that I can't make this decision with my property.
So is this another example of the rural-urban divide and the cultural polarization that drives so much of contemporary American politics, including other conflicts like gun rights and vaccine mandates?
Yes, you have your finger right on the pulse of it, Leonard. And how I talk about this in the book is, you know, there were very few locally situated environmental advocates that were against fracking. There is one local group, the Responsible Drilling Alliance, who's based in Williamsport. But what happened in the time that I was there that really brought this into stark relief was there was a number of incidents where many activists from other places came in to protest. So one famous example was when Yoko Ono and Sean Lennon and Susan Sarandon brought a bus from New York City through you know, parts of Appalachian, Pennsylvania on a tour with journalists to show them, you know, how much fracking is damaging the landscape. And then another incident that happened was there was
What was the reaction to Yoko, Sean, sure, and such?
It was disgust. It was, you know, look at these people who know nothing about this area, these liberals from the city, you know, who don't know anything about the way that we live or energy. And, you know, how are they driving that bus? That bus is driven with gasoline.
Yeah.
They're probably living in a high-rise apartment that's heated with fracked gas from Pennsylvania.
We hear the same arguments when there's a debate over oil pipelines.
Yes, that's right. And you know, interesting, one thing I'll point out to, just as a more general thing, I mean, I focus on one community, but if you look at survey research, people that live closer to fracked gas wells and people that live closer to pipelines support them more than people that live farther away. And so there's this idea, you know, a lot of times we think about people that are protesting pipelines and things like a natural gas well or oil well is not in my backyard activism. And certainly there's some of that. I don't mean to caricature the situation. But one of the things that the research shows is that it's more of a not in your backyard movement, that people that are opposed to these things are largely urban based and coastal based and are engaging in forms of activism in which they give money to generate activism in local communities or sort of bring activists in, literally sometimes on buses. And that this, you know, and this really turned locals off even more, so much so that when things started to go wrong for some of them, even though they were upset with the oil and gas industry, they didn't want to go public because they said, you know, I don't want to be seen as one of those liberal fractivists. And so very much the rural urban divide was on display here.
But isn't it a fact that some of the reddest counties and states suffer the most from pollution? And this contributes to that pollution.
You know, you're
Do they
exactly
not
right.
see the irony there?
There is an irony, and I think, you know, this is an irony that I think has been well explored. I mean, there's the famous book, What's the Matter with Kansas? There's other, you know, studies which the idea there is that, you know, that people who are voting for conservatives seem voting against their interests, right? There's the more recent book, Dying of Whiteness, for instance. And I think what I would say about that is there is an irony. I don't want to insinuate at all that people that act this way are somehow duped. I think it's a very conscious choice to prioritize certain values over other things. And so, you know, I think people so much value land sovereignty and live and let live and being left to themselves that even when things went wrong, it wasn't that they just said, you know, I'm not going to do anything. It wasn't that they weren't upset. The few families I followed that wound up with contaminated water were very angry. Their answer was to sue the company that contaminated their water. So it wasn't that they didn't care or they didn't, but they, even then their approach was, well, I was wronged in the contract that I signed. And so I want to make things right through the legal system, but not that the answer would be greater regulation.
Lycoming County is a Rust Belt area. Had it been in economic decline before the oil companies arrived?
That's right. I mean, I don't want to paint too bleak of a picture. It has fared better than some others because there are two colleges located there. There's one hospital right in Williamsport, another one outside that provides some jobs. But nonetheless, this and there's some local manufacturing, but this is a place that has seen its population decline by more than a third.
What happened
today
to the farms?
Yeah, so many of the farms. I mean, this basically, you know, dairy and meat are the basic. There's not a lot of people growing food here, and those farms, a lot of them disappeared. There are still people doing it, but there's not really money to be made doing that, especially, you know, compared to the large agricultural actors. And so, a lot of the folks I met, for instance, they owned land that they inherited that was a farm, but now it's not, or they were farming, but part-time, right? It wasn't, they couldn't actually make a living doing it. So they were doing something else, but still keeping some dairy cows, mostly out of pride.
So they were eager to accept the huge sums of money that were offered by energy companies. How much money is offered?
It varies tremendously. And I should, to be clear, there's two primary ways that you get money. From when you first lease your land, you get paid a bonus. And then if they do drill underneath your property and extract gas, you get royalties every month from that. As far as the leasing bonus, people that signed early that didn't know that this was going to be a huge thing signed for quite little, sometimes as little as $5 an acre. So that's not that much money. People who signed later after all the landmen, as they call them, the people that try to get leases started coming to town and rumors started to circulate about all this gas underground. And some homeowners decided to band together with other landowners and say, let's collectively bargain as a block. Some folks got as much as $5,000 per acre. So that's the bonus. And then royalties, you know, it really depends how much you own. I'll put it in perspective I'll give you one example. So one of the main characters of the book, George Hagemeyer, he leased for very little. He had 77 acres. He only leased for $5 an acre. So he didn't make that much money doing that. But then
you open the book with him.
And what's that?
You open the book with him.
Yeah.
With his story. Because he's typical.
He's, you know, it's really tough to say typical. I call it the fracking lottery because there are people that just got a bonus and got nothing afterwards. And then there's people that get a lot of money off of royalties, and there's people in the middle. I would say he's on the upper end, of people that I met as far as life-changing amounts of money. But he's not so atypical. There are others like him. So he leased for $5 an acre. However, then the gas company wanted to put a pipeline, bury a pipeline underneath his property. He got $60,000 for that. And then once they started drilling the gas, they put 6 gas wells in his backyard. His first royalty check, which was just for 1 month of production, was $33,000 for 1 month.
I could see why he appreciated that. But you talked with people on all sides of the issue of fracking in the area. Were you surprised by the wide and sometimes contradictory positions that they took?
I was. So the first thing I should say is I was surprised at how many people supported it. You know, I had this idea, you never know what you're going to find, but I imagined when I moved there that the book was going to be how fracking split this town in half. And that wasn't the case. Almost everybody supported it. So that was the first surprise. But then the second surprise was is in the details. So I spend time with one person, for instance, Cindy Bauer, who is against fracking. She's a member of the Responsible Drilling Alliance, which is an anti-fracking advocacy group. She was also involved in a lawsuit trying to prevent the distribution of royalties from drilling on state land going to the general fund. And she argued that they should be going back into conservation. And she also has a fair amount of money. She's definitely upper class and so didn't need the money from leasing. And she refused to lease her land. She owns 150 acres, her and her husband. But eventually she did lease. And that was a big surprise. Here is somebody who doesn't need the money from leasing. Here is somebody who wishes that fracking would go away, but in the end she leased. And there was a really valuable lesson in that, which is that, you know, she refused to lease for years and it didn't change anything. Everybody around her leased, everybody else almost in the entire county leased. So she was still dealing with the well pad right across the street from her where drilling was going on, the road being chewed up, light pollution, noise pollution, caravans of big rig trucks. So finally, she just basically said, well, I deserve something for the quality of life disturbances and suffering that I've had to endure for years. And so she finally gave up and leased and really just viewed it as recompense, as a form of reparation for the harm that had been done. And that was another surprise. The last surprise I'll say, which actually gets to the gentleman we were just discussing, is George Hagemeyer. I brought him to my class in a stretch, and he decided to take a stretch limousine because he was, you know, newly flush in money. And I had brought him to talk about, as someone who supports fracking, I actually brought in somebody else, Ralph Kisberg, who's a co-founder of the Responsible Drilling Alliance. And the idea was Ralph was going to give the anti-fracking view and George was going to give the pro-fracking view. And then he said in front of my whole class, I wish I didn't sign. So that was another surprise.
Well, you mentioned that he has to share space with security guard shack, with portable toilets for the people who work these rigs, the caravans of big rigs, the drilling equipment, the earth movers. This was once a beautiful area, and now isn't it largely pretty ugly to look at?
That's right. You know, yes, and this precisely feeds into his regret. I mean, acre-wise, most of his land is untouched. I mean, he owns 77 acres. Most of it is wooded. The well pad itself is about 4 acres, and then there's a gravel driveway that they carved through to it. But visually, that's right where his house is. And so yes, what happened was, I think what I say is George didn't realize how much sovereignty he would be giving up to the oil and gas company. So he had no control where they put the driveway. So they put this gravel driveway right next to his house where there's big rig trucks rumbling by each day. They put a security camera on his well pad that he didn't know about. And then when the security camera recorded him walking on the well pad, he was told that he wasn't allowed on the well pad and that he could be arrested because the well pad
is
owned by the oil and gas company. He didn't know that they were going to withdraw millions of gallons of water from his creek until he saw a notice in the classified section of the newspaper.
You're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York 99.5 FM and streaming live at WBAI.org.
Headaches, blackouts, and nosebleeds. Pump jack poison and all this greed. We lived our lives without fear before the drilling rigs got here. Darkness coming, I can feel it in my bones. Man comes with a pocket full of gold. I got mules to shoe and I got mouths to feed, a woman to hold and dirt to seed.
Before I get back to my conversation with Professor Colin Jarlmack, I'd like to take a moment to ask you to consider becoming a member of WBAI. We need all of our listeners to step up right now by going online to give2wbai.org or by calling 212-209-2950 to help keep this show and the station on the air in the wake of this terrible pandemic. We can't just drill below the station and get some oil or gas. We really need your support. Again, that number is 212-209-2950. Or you can go to give2wbai.org online. And a great way to support WBAI throughout the year while spreading out your financial commitment so that it's only a small amount taken out of your credit card or bank account each month is to become a sustaining member of the station, what we call a BAI buddy. And I'm delighted to announce that anyone who signs up to become a BAI buddy in the name of Leonard Lopate at Large right now will receive a free copy of the book that we've been discussing on today's show, Up to Heaven and Down to Hell, Fracking, Freedom, and Community in an American Town by my guest, Colin Jarlmack. But no matter what level you're able to show your support for this show and the station that brings it to you weekdays from 1 to 2 p.m., it all helps. The important thing is to take that step to keep the show coming to you and all of your fellow listeners by calling 212-209-2950 or going online to give2wbai.org, because, you know, our listeners are our only source of funding. So the only way we can keep independent radio alive on the New York radio dial is with the help of listeners like you. And we need your support now more than ever. So I hope you'll go to your phone or computer and make that tax-deductible donation right now. But please don't forget to make the contribution in the name of Leonard Lopate at Large. And we return now to my guest, Colin Jarlmack. I'm pronouncing your name correctly. His book, Up to Heaven and Down to Hell, Fracking, Freedom, and Community in an American Town, published by Princeton University Press. Even if you don't lease your land, your neighbors will lease, which means that you're going to suffer from the environmental cost no matter what. So isn't it just smarter to join them?
Yes, Leonard. Unfortunately, that it is. And this is, you know, people who write about environmental problems, you know, the exploitation of scarce resources, they, you know, they talk about this as a classic collective action problem or resource dilemma where, you know, people can understand as a whole that, gee, if all of us leased our land, you know, we might lose the rural character of this place. We might risk some aspects of landscape destruction or even water contamination. But if there's no mechanism to prevent, you know, everybody from signing individually, so I can decide, just as you said, so if I, it makes no sense for me to hold back as an individual landowner, because I recognize that even if I don't, everybody else will. So I might as well make some money, even if I have an understanding that all of us leasing might create these environmental problems.
And what do they say to environmental activists who point to the dangers of fracking to drinking water in poison wells to destroyed roads to noise pollution, local air pollution, the air pollution, because it releases carcinogens into people's backyards.
Yes. You know, this is where, I mean, it's as regards to what do they say? I mean, it's really maybe what do they say to each other or to me, because there's really almost no conversation happening between environmentalists and landowners, unfortunately. I think there's this, well, it's interesting because, so for instance, a couple people that I came to know who wound up with their water became laced with methane, they were angry with the oil and gas company, but they would say things, in some ways I was surprised that not all of them, but some of them would even minimize it or say things like, well, you know, the water around here is, we're all drilling our own water wells. And, you know, we know there's all kinds of issues with the water around here. And so if it's not this, it could be something else. That's what some people said, which surprised me. And other people just said, you know, as I alluded to before, well, I'm upset with what's happening, but I'm just going to, you know, I'm going to, I think lawsuits are the answer, not greater regulation. I think a thing that a lot of them said was they felt that environmentalists exaggerated the problem. So, you know, famously in 2010, the film Gasland showed flaming faucets, you know, because there was so much methane in them that you could light them on fire. This stoked what became the predominant narrative, which is that fracking is going to poison our aquifers. And the truth of the matter is, and this is cold comfort to the people who have wound up with their water wells being undrinkable, but there's not been major contamination of aquifers that provide water for thousands or millions of people. There have been numerous individual cases. As I mentioned, I followed one group of six families who lived on a road who wound up with explosive levels of methane in their water. But the sort of doomsday narrative of environmentalists did not really come to pass in most places. And so I think in some ways the and not all environmentalists were so catastrophic or hyperbolic in their narratives, but a lot of them were. And I think that might have been to their detriment, because it was easy for people living here to say, oh, they say everybody's going to have cancer, and they say that none of us are going to be able to drink our water, and we haven't seen that. And so that sort of allowed them to dismiss all of the claims made by environmentalists, even though a number of the claims made by environmentalists are so-called fractivists, anti-fracking activists, had a lot of merit to them.
Isn't there also a sense of community involved here? Don't many support land leasing, even if they themselves don't make money from it, because of their political belief in self-reliance and land sovereignty, but also because they are defending the freedom of their neighbors to lease, and they believe that supporting fracking is a matter of standing up or standing with your neighbors.
That's right. And that was more one of the more surprising things that I found. I presume that, you know, I wasn't surprised that people would support fracking because they make money. It was interesting how much partisan identity mattered as well, although not as surprising, but, you know, people who are pro free market, anti-regulation, supported on political grounds. But because people often talked about themselves in this, you know, as in the singular, like, I do what I want, you know, they often talked about themselves as if they were these rugged people living in the mountains who had no social connections. The community part surprised me, you know, and I tell this story through some particular people. So, for instance, Tom and Mary Crawley, who were one of the families that wound up with contaminated water, when that happened, they were trying to get their local representative to hold the gas company accountable, to talk to the Department of Environmental Protection. And they were very frustrated, but this spilled over at a town hall meeting. But when the local reporter went up to talk to them afterwards, they refused to give their name or share their story. They wouldn't talk to me for 7 months. It took me before they would talk to me. And when I finally sat down with them, what they said was, even though we're dealing with all this, we're really worried. We saw those protesters. We saw people camping out, you know, like picketing gas wells and the like. And we're really worried that our neighbor's property who hosts the gas well, that environmentalists are going to show up and harass them or protest there. And it's not our neighbor's fault. It's the gas company's fault. And so here they were with contaminated water. They couldn't afford a lawyer. There was an environmental group that was offering them a free lawyer, but they didn't want to take it. And they didn't want to talk to the environmental group or share their story, because that's how concerned they were with their neighbors being, you know, in their view, being harassed. And so I say precisely that that part of showing public support for fracking, even when you've lost the fracking lottery, is that you're standing with the community. And they also would point to, they said, well, you know, our neighbors were able to keep their farm. They were going to sell it, and now they got to keep it. So it didn't work out for me, but it worked out for them. And I don't want to do something that would negatively harm their ability to hold on to their farm.
They're kind of, these people value personal freedom and property rights and are cynical of state and federal government. But they also believe in working for the civic association for the betterment of local community. Again, right. Another contradiction, it seems to me.
You're precisely right. And, you know, what really made that clear to me was I went to a lot of board of supervisor hearings in small townships. These are basically where new land use proposals are debated. People can come who live in the township and express concerns, and then the board of supervisors makes the decision. You know, for instance, it might be whether a bakery is going to be allowed in a part of the area that is zoned at, you know, residential or agricultural. And one of the things that I was very impressed by was how much people would turn out to these tiny little hearings and would argue for or against, in effect, restricting somebody's property rights for the public good. You know, they would say so-and-so shouldn't be able to put a cell phone tower on the property because here's the impact it's going to have. We can't have another liquor license for this new restaurant because that's too many potential drunk drivers on the road. And so I saw the people were very involved, and specifically, ironically, given the way they thought about property rights as being so sacrosanct, that they often debated that certain land uses ought not happen, ought not be allowed by the Board of Supervisors precisely because they would damage the public good. And the thing about fracking is fracking didn't apply, as I already mentioned, to these local zoning rules. And so fracking was not something where they could have the same public input into. And so that's where I think that I argue in the book that I do think that if municipalities had the ability to control fracking through zoning locally, that even though people may be pro-industry and pro-property rights, you would see greater restrictions and regulations at the local level, because I saw people doing this for other things. They valued the rural character of the area they lived in and did not want it to be industrialized.
But there is a process of deforestation. You have to knock down trees to clear land so you can do the drilling.
That's right. This isn't exactly in your question, but where you see that quite a bit, not just, you know, not just small segments of maybe somebody's backyard, is Pennsylvania has leased hundreds of thousands of acres of state forest for drilling. And I spent some time in some of those forests, and there are areas, Tyodotten Forest has dozens of oil and gas wells, and every single one of them has a 4-acre clearance. And then the impoundment ponds where they store the water that they use to frack the wells are 12 acres. And they have several of those. And then they clear areas for pipelines. And even though the pipeline's only 6 inches, they clear 125-foot right of way that remains grass. And so you're right. It does lead to significant deforestation.
So this is also, so the state also leases land to increase the state budget?
That's right. There's currently a moratorium on new leases. But when the fracking boom first took off, Ed Rendell, who was the Democratic governor between 2008 and 2010, leased almost 140,000 acres, and that was in addition to earlier leases that had occurred. And those leases between 2008 and 2010 brought in over $400 million. So, you know, that plugs a lot of state budget holes.
Now, you mentioned opposition to cell phone towers. Isn't it in the best interest to have a cell phone tower?
Yes, that's true. And I should just be clear, Leonard, I don't want to paint the picture that there's like massive opposition to all cell phone towers. It's just to point out that I did attend a hearing where there was debate about whether a cell phone tower ought to be allowed because people argued about their own property value or their own viewshed. And so I think, people still want cell phone towers. They want to have the main thing I would say about that is like anything else is people want to be able to have a say in land use decisions that affect them. And so if you feel that you're going to be personally affected by this, you want to at least be able to express your concerns and perhaps have an opportunity for these things to get developed in a way that lessens their impact on you.
My guest on today's Leonard Lopate at Large here on WBAI New York 99.5 FM, streaming live at WBAI.org, is Colin Jaromak, professor of environmental studies and sociology at NYU. His previous book, The Global Pigeon, the one we're discussing, Up to Heaven and Down to Hell, Fracking, Freedom, and Community in an American Town. It's published by Princeton University Press. How do they respond when you bring up the issue of climate change?
Largely, certainly some concern. I mean, again, I did follow some people who were against drilling, fracking, and very much pitched it in terms of climate change. But I would say, if not denial, apathy. Climate change is not a top priority for many of the folks that I met. Folks thought that it was, I wouldn't say I met so many people that refused to believe it was happening, but felt that it was, but did feel that the language of the doomsday scenarios were overblown. And we really just say, we got a lot of other things to worry about. We got to try to stay out of wars in the Middle East, which developing this resource helps us do. Gas burns cleaner than coal. So even for this, you could argue it's better for climate change. And a lot of people just said, look, we're in an area that doesn't have a lot of money. We've seen decline of industries and jobs and decline of population. And so we got to put food on the table and try to keep our kids in the community. And so that's our priority. That's our bread and butter. There really wasn't, I did bring it up to people, but it really wasn't even something that was on their radar. They just had a lot of concerns that were a lot more palpable to them than that.
Do you think you would have pretty much seen the same thing if you'd gone to some of the other areas where fracking is taking place?
I do. I always hesitate to characterize huge stretches of America, but I do know I would rely here on, certainly we know from survey data that if you identify as conservative or Republican, you are much less likely to believe that climate change is real or that it's being caused by people. And the thing about fracking, and this is a pure coincidence of geology, but almost all of the oil and gas reserves are located in the heartland, stretching from Pennsylvania to the Midwest. And so almost all the major areas where oil and gas drilling are occurring are in conservative areas. And so that's where I would say that I do think that you would tend to find this kind of response in many of the places where oil and gas drilling is occurring.
What does fracking's prevalence tell us about the broader environmental movement in America?
I think in some ways the limits of what can be done through the federal government, because I mean, as we talked about at the top of your show, Leonard, Biden can't actually ban fracking if he wanted to. I mean, through congressional action, you could. It's hard for me to ever imagine that would happen. But not with
this Congress.
Right. And so I think that, the thing about fracking is where you are seeing winning is at the local level. So as I mentioned, and as you well know, the state of New York has banned fracking in New York State. There are certain municipalities in areas of Texas and Colorado who have fought locally, who have fought permits for oil and gas wells. Even sometimes they're being sued by the state because they're not allowed to stop these things, but they're still doing them. And so I would just say where you're seeing success and where I would like to see environmentalism focus more of their energy is on these local fights, because fracking is not really going to be, I don't see it being taken down in flick of a switch by the federal government. There are going to be dozens or hundreds of these local fights. And I think there, part of what the environmental movement, I think, needs to try to do a little bit more, I talk about this in the conclusion of my book, is think about ways of crafting a message that appeals to many of the local conservative residents living here. So a lot of the folks I met, they didn't want gas wells drilled so close to water wells. They didn't want hundreds of big rig trucks on the roads when you could pipe the water in on a temporary pipeline next to the road instead. So it's to say they wanted certain things changed, but to them, environmentalists were their emphasis was on top-down regulation from the federal or the state level, not the community playing a role in making decisions. So what I found is, folks may even want and support local environmental regulation, even if they're conservative, but it has to be something that they play a part in crafting. And so I would like to see and environmentalism that is more attuned to the role of local movements and local control over resources.
You said earlier that the history behind the Founding Fathers' decision to grant whoever owns the soil to own it up to heaven and down to hell was inspired by things like John Locke's Declaration of Private Property as a natural right. And so it's really, really a British idea, but is one of the big differences that in England, the crown retained exclusive rights to all subsurface oil, gas, coal, silver, and gold?
That's right. And so this was something that, you know, the so-called founding fathers, this was an explicit decision when independence was won. You know, they were obsessed with preventing the federal government from, you know, the tyranny of government, right? Preventing the government from being able to control people's private decisions. And so one of the things that they were very adamant about was finding ways to ensure that people could enjoy the fruits of their own labor. And so they recognized that if people would be beholden to the government, if it was up to the government to decide whether to drill underneath your property to get out the oil and gas, and that if individuals own the property and that they either labored through mining themselves or they hired somebody privately to mine it, that it ought to be their right to enjoy the fruits of their labor, which was explicitly in Lockean. John Locke said, land only attains value when it is transformed through labor. And so whoever owns the property, whoever transforms land through labor should own the results of that labor. And so this was a very conscious choice to break with Britain. And they worried that allowing the federal government to retain mineral rights would be allowing the federal government to control the individual.
Is it your sense that despite its destructive aspects, that fracking is going to be with us for quite a while?
Yes, unfortunately. I mean, I do think I certainly have more reason for optimism with the current administration than I've had before. You know, but there's, as has been well talked about in the news, there's only so much that can be done through executive actions. And it's hard to think that there's going to be the support to simply ban fracking. And there's enough oil and gas to keep this thing going for a long time. I think the biggest hope that you see environmentalists and progressives talking about is a so-called clean energy standard, which would still have to pass Congress. And that's where it gets tough. But a clean energy standard would not ban fracking itself, but it would mandate that by a given year, whether that's 2035, we will have net zero emissions from our energy sector. And so if something like a clean energy standard passes, then, which I think is a high bar, but if it did, we would see the decline of fracking. But I think it's going to be with us for a while.
Is it inexpensive in comparison to some of the other ways we get our energy?
No, it's not. And I should say, a lot of wells that are drilled lose money. One of the things that I remember, there was a Bloomberg news report that argued that fracking has always sort of been a losing game, that basically it costs so much to drill these wells, and some of them are super productive. So the ones that are quite productive, you make money off of, but a lot of them you lose money off of. And so you need to keep drilling. You need to keep drilling in hopes of striking the next jackpot. Fracking is incredibly expensive enterprise. However, we are producing so much of this stuff now, especially gas, that there's a glut. There's such a glut of gas that the price has gone, you know, at times it fluctuates so low that some of the wells that have been drilled are capped. We don't want the gas going to market because there's not a market for it. And it's losing money that way because it costs so much to drill it, but there's still so much of it that the price isn't where the industry would like it to be a lot of the time.
Although gas prices have gone up in all of the gas stations in my area, they're rather high now. They're in the $3 range. I want to thank you so much for being on our show. I've been speaking with Colin Jarlmack, who is professor of environmental studies and sociology at NYU. His latest book, Up to Heaven and Down to Hell, Fracking, Freedom, and Community in an American Town, published by Princeton University Press. It's been a great pleasure talking with you.
This has been a lot of fun, Leonard. Thank you so much.
And I'm sad to say that brings us to the end of this show. My special thanks to our live engineer, Reggie Johnson, and to my executive producer, Jesse Lent, for all of the important work that they do throughout the week. If you're just discovering this program and would like to hear more of our one-hour deep dive interviews, you can access past shows streaming on demand at WBAI.org. We're also available on Spotify, iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts. And if you'd like to comment on a show or just want to say hello, my email address is leonardlopate@wbai.org. Before I sign off today, I need to ask you to step up right now and support Leonard Lopate at Large so that we can keep bringing you the informative, in-depth interviews you've come to expect from us. So please go online right now to give to WBAI.org or call 212-209-2950 to help keep Leonard Lopate at Large and WBAI on the air. And one great way to support us without having to lay out a lot of money at one time is to become a BAI buddy. They're listeners who contribute $10, $15, $20 or more each month to keep the station running and to show their support for what we do on this show. As I mentioned at the half, anyone who becomes a BAI buddy in the name of Leonard Lopate at Large during today's show will receive a free copy of the book we've been discussing, Up to Heaven and Down to Hell, Fracking, Freedom, and Community in American Town, by my guest Colin Jarlmack. Our way of saying thanks, but to get it, you must make that call right now. One last time, the number 212-209-2950, or you can go online to give2wbai.org. And please make your contribution in the name of Leonard Lopate at Large. And thanks. We hope you'll join us on Monday when prison reform advocate Marlon Peterson will discuss his recent memoir, Bird Uncaged, an abolitionist freedom song. You won't want to miss it. Have a great weekend.
For WPFW Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Askia Muhammad. Here are some headlines. The trial of Derek Chauvin continued today with Lindsay Thomas, a consulting forensic pathologist in Minneapolis, testifying that George Floyd's death was, quote, due to the activities of law enforcement officers, specifically from the restraint and neck compression administered to the 46-year-old. Thomas, who ruled out that drug overdose was a cause of Floyd's death, added, quote, this was not a sudden death. Thomas's testimony came after an expert on respiratory system testified that George Floyd died from a low level of oxygen and that the pressure from Chauvin's knee on the Floyd's neck would have killed any person in good health. The defense is hoping to build a case that Floyd's drug use was the cause of his death and not Chauvin's knee on his neck. But that is not what the jury is hearing. Yesterday, a forensic toxicologist at the laboratory that tested Floyd's blood said the amount of methamphetamine found in his blood and urine would not have been sufficient to cause intoxication. The Centers for Disease Control has declared racism a serious public health threat, becoming the largest federal agency to do so. In a statement published on the agency's website, CDC Director Rochelle Walensky said, quote, a growing body of research shows that centuries of racism in this country has had a profound and negative impact on communities of color. Walensky noted the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic has been felt most severely in communities of color, which have experienced disproportionate case counts and deaths. The declaration is part of a new agency-wide initiative called Racism and Health, which the CDC said is meant to be a hub for its research into the effects of racism on health and efforts to achieve health equity. It's been 11 days since Amazon workers in Bessemer, Alabama, cast their votes on whether to unionize. As of last night, early results from the election show that workers appear to be leaning toward rejecting the unionization push by a 2-to-1 margin. But only around half of the 3,200 ballots have been counted. The National Labor Relations Board is expected to finish counting the votes today. Meanwhile, the labor rights media group More Perfect Union has revealed Amazon executives coerced the U.S. Postal Service to install a private mailbox at the Bessemer warehouse so the company could pressure workers to mail their ballots from work and monitor their votes. President Biden today asked Congress to authorize a massive $1.5 trillion federal spending plan in 2022, seeking to invest heavily in government agencies to boost education, expand public housing, combat the coronavirus, and confront climate change. The president's blueprint calls for a nearly 16% increase in funding across non-defense domestic programs, reflecting the White House's belief that bigger government and spending can close the country's persistent economic gaps. DMX, beloved rapper and songwriter,